It's really a privilege to be asked here by the Kahn Institute to give a talk. Now, I'm from New York originally. I talk very fast, I talk very loudly, so hopefully I will get through the whole talk and there'll be room for some questions at the end. And I'm also a little bit technologically challenged, so let's see if I can get this working. Okay, in 1982, the California Department of Mental Health launched the nation's first statewide mental health campaign called Friends Are Good Medicine. This campaign used both the mass media and community discussions to inform Californians about the role that supportive relationships with friends and family can play in protecting their physical and mental health. It encouraged people to make an investment in their friendships. Part of it was to shake the hand of the person next to you on a bus. We would not do this on the subway in New York, I have to tell you. And they created 25 talk show presentations. They distributed a 64-page workbook with exercises on relationship building. They printed 62,000 copies of a brochure, Can Friends Help You Stay Well? It had a stress test, so you would then feel upset, I guess, and then they talked about all the benefits of social support. Articles appeared in local newspapers. They had a film trailer called Friends, which was probably the idea for the show. And they distributed more than 70,000 bumper stickers and shopping bags. Okay. The Journal of the American Medical Association responded to this campaign with an editorial titled, "A Friend, Not an Apple a Day, Will Keep the Doctor Away." So the message was very clear. Social support is good medicine. Like chicken soup, its powers were believed to be pervasive, good for everybody, despite the fact that in 1982, there was absolutely no science to support that statement. Since then, there have been thousands of studies, from interactions among mice litter mates, to collegiality among students in a college dorm, to group therapy for women with advanced breast cancer, to research that shows if you don't have friends, you're gonna catch a cold. Research evidence has been garnered across all the ologies to support the notion that interpersonal relationships are related to better health and well-being. And on the flip side of that, an article in the journal Science in the late 80s made it pretty clear that social isolation was very bad for your health. It pointed out that, and here's the conclusion of the article, social isolation has a relative risk for all-cause morbidity and mortality that is similar to other major risk factors, equivalent to cigarette smoking, inactivity, and obesity. Okay, so the big questions, if friends are good medicine, is why are close relationships important? What are the pathways between relationships and well-being? What sorts of social interactions matter? And can social relationships both help and hinder coping with chronic stress? So as psychologists, we really wanted to look behind that statement, unlike public health people, to look at the mechanisms. How, why, when, for whom are close relationships good medicine? In my research career, I focused primarily on this question for a particular population, people living with a chronic illness. So today, I'm gonna give you a very quick tour through the research on how, when, why, whether, and which interpersonal relationships are good medicine for people living with chronic illnesses. I'll present some theories. I'm gonna give you data, hopefully, from two different studies that I've done recently. I'll talk about the effect of the illness on the patient, on the partner, on the relationship. And I'll talk about how couples coping together can affect pain, function, and mental health. Now, let me tell you, if you do your computerized lit search, as my former student Ann Gancars used to do for me all the time, you would find thousands of studies that have focused on coping, coping with illness. And almost all of them are about coping efforts by individuals. But I think, as Vanita talked about in her introduction, living with chronic illness is not experienced in a social vacuum. Most coping efforts take place either implicitly or explicitly within an interpersonal context. So when one family member is ill, the other people in the family are affected as well. It's sort of intuitive, right? Another one of these truisms we could put on a shopping bag. But it surprised me that even 10 years ago, how few researchers investigated at all how either intimate partners or family members coped with the stressors that a member of their family were living with, and how the coping efforts, for example, of partners in a couple mutually influence each other. Now, let me just backtrack for a minute. and tell you how I came to study this, because I think part of it is we spend a lot of time drinking, and, you know, when we're in grad school, trying to figure out, why do you study what you study? Is it, you know, everybody always says, oh, I know, one of your parents was probably very ill, right? No. But how do you come to what you're going to study? So I came to graduate school in psychology to study how custody decisions affect the child. I didn't do very well my first year. I was sort of thrashing around. I didn't have a mentor. And then I was about to leave the program, and my mother said, no, please, get a master's. But I was lucky enough my second year to meet the woman that would become my mentor. And she had just started a longitudinal study of coping and adaptation to illness among older people. Now remember, I came to do custody decisions in children, but I thought, very smart woman, I'll learn stuff, and then I'll do my dissertation on custody decisions. This illness, which I never did, but I have a lot of files in my file cabinet on it. This was a study, which you probably can't do today given funding, that looked at four different illnesses: hypertension, diabetes, cancer, and rheumatoid arthritis. And the big questions were whether the personal controllability and medical controllability of the disease affected adaptation. And at that point, no one had studied coping efforts. And so the idea would be how you coped led to better adaptation. Okay, now, I was a dutiful student. I was new to this kind of research. And so when we were sent out to patients' homes all over New York City, one was in Staten Island, it took 3 hours to get there on the ferry. I mean, it was sort of my opening eyes to really doing that kind of field research. And very often, I'd be interviewing the patient with this three-hour protocol, and the partner would walk into the room and sit down and say, well, what about me? Don't you want to know how I'm feeling? And I was like, well, no, I'm here to interview the patient. But actually, what I would do is I'd finish, you know, I'd band that person back to the den or whatever. But then when the interview was done, I would make sure that I stayed an extra hour. And I think any of you who've done field research in anthropology or psychology know the best stuff happens when the interview is over. So, you know, when they'd serve me coffee and cake, in one instance it was figs from a tree in Brooklyn, it was really neat. I would sort of talk to the partner and sort of say, well, how's it affected you? Sometimes I gave them a few questions from the interview. Now, as I teach ethics now, I'm not sure that was ethical. I once pretended to record it with the tape recorder because the person insisted. But I think part of it was that's what really opened my eyes, though I was focusing on the patient and the research, that really the partner was dying to talk, to disclose, to cope with the illness as well. And it seemed to me that the partners of people with chronic illness were stuck between a rock and a hard place. So in grad school, and then when I became a professor, I began to study how couples really coped with a particular illness, not a life-threatening illness, but rheumatoid arthritis. And I thought that rheumatoid arthritis was just a great illness to study in the sense of that it's not curable. Well, actually, let's switch over. It's not curable. So people aren't dying from it, but it's also going to last your whole life. It has intense pain, flare episodes, which means that it's very unpredictable. The pain and the joint swelling can lead to disability. So the mom, who's always been the head of the PTA, can now barely get her kids to school. And it really required communication between partners and families in terms of social support. I remember one person in my study that the partner said to me, I don't get it. Yesterday she was in pain. She couldn't do anything. So I went to the market and I made dinner. I got up this morning, I made an omelet, she walks in and says, get out of my kitchen. And part of it is, you don't know what's gonna happen day to day or hour to hour. And I thought this was, in a sense, a wonderful paradigm, a wonderful way to study social support exchange. I want to give you theory and models, because what we do as psychologists is we draw boxes and arrows, like Earl Guthrie's song. And also, as you know, Kurt Lewin, who is a very famous psychologist, the motto of our program is, there is nothing as good as a good theory. Most research on coping with illness uses a model like this and finds its roots in, this is what's called the stress and coping paradigm, which was developed in the early 80s by Richard Lazarus and Susan Folkman. This is still the paradigm, with a little tweaking, that's used in research on coping with stress even today, a quarter century later. And I want to point out, let's see if I can use this laser thing. No cats in the room, right? I'm not good at this. Did you get that?
Yes.
I'm not going to do Star Wars. I'm just kidding. Okay. There are two very important tenets to this model that are going to be important for the research I talk about later. One is that stress is a perceived phenomenon, that you have what are called cognitive appraisals of stress. So the same event, the same thing may be more or less stressful for different people. You know that the most stressful thing ever is having to give a public talk, but I don't mind doing that at all. So obviously it's based on our appraisals, and we can make appraisals of harm that's happened in the past, such as when there's a death, or future threats to our well-being, or even possibly frame a stressor as a challenge, as something to be conquered. So cognitive appraisal processes are really critical for starting the coping process going. The second part that was very important to me about this model is that coping is not the same as personality. That coping is the interaction or transaction between personal resources and environmental or situational demands. So it's not just, thank God, it is not just that you are an optimistic person and so you're going to cope better with a stressor. And it's not just that you have lots of friends and family around. So that those components all sort of meld together to sort of predict or shape coping responses. And then coping, in turn, is going to lead to outcomes, whether we talk about emotions or distress, or what I could also have added on to that was physical health. Now, within this original paradigm, where does social support sit? Well, at that point, social support was really conceptualized as an external resource. It's out there. You have friends and family to count on, or you don't. And there were basically three types of support that people talked about. Emotional support, which means you're getting the goodies from friends to make you feel loved and valued. Informational support, which provides feedback about how you're coping or provides you with new information about your illness. And tangible support from others, like carrying out the coping actions. One of the biggest items on tangible support scales, and they still use this, is someone loaned you $25. Someone took your kids to school. Someone shopped for you. So it's really getting those sort of daily living things done. And in this way, social support was really thought of as coping assistance. And of the hundreds of studies done in the 1980s and 1990s, we basically found that was social support related to better outcomes, to better physical health, to mental health? The answer was basically yes. That's a positive correlation. The more support you have, the better your health, the better your well-being. Hence the shopping bag, friends are good medicine. So for people living with a chronic illness, there are numerous studies that show that receiving greater support from friends or family, or just even perceiving, thinking, oh, you'd be available if something happened, is related to lower depression, better positive mood, less pain, better functional ability, better immune function, and use of more adaptive coping strategies. So we did all walk around in the 80s saying friends are good medicine and everybody should be in a support group. Okay, but not all support acts this way. And in an early study, actually pulling out the cancer patients from that larger study I did in grad school, I noticed that patients talked about the things that network members thought were helpful, but they weren't. So here were partners and other family members saying, oh, I do this, I take them to the doctor and I make sure that they listen and then I make sure they take their medication. And patients might say, they are on my back all the time telling me to take my pills. That's a phenomenon known as social control, which I don't study. I just do it. But my husband would say. But for example, negative or problematic types of support or criticizing someone's coping efforts, providing advice that someone didn't ask for and is unwanted, that's a real biggie for people with chronic illness. Or when a close person avoids talking about the illness because they think it's going to make you feel worse, okay? I called this problematic support because when I first wrote an article and called it negative support, the critique was that's an oxymoron. If it's supportive, it's good based on that correlation. So problematic seemed to resonate better with people. And I decided, let me examine the relationship of positive and problematic support among patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So this was one of the early studies I did with 100 patients, women and men, newly diagnosed with RA. And we ask participants to describe their social networks using this sort of bullseye. Who's closest to you, who's next close, and people would write things out in the ring. So their baseball team was sort of in the sixth ring, and how many people do you count for that? Dead people were in the ring, dogs were in the ring. My graduate students had a great time coding it because we really had to think about it. No, if support is a perceptual construct, if you think that you're receiving support from this source, then it really is support. Until one of my students said, yes, Tracy, but the dog picked up the groceries. How do we code that? So it really leads you to the sense of how people are, you know, in psychology, it's perception, and how are people seeing these constructs, okay? So we did find, as predicted, that there was a relationship, more of what I called positive support, the emotional, informational, tangible support I had on the last slide, was related to better mental health outcomes for people with RA. And as predicted, having more problematic support was related to worse outcomes. But there was an interesting interaction that's depicted in this graph. And what we found is it's the combo of positive and problematic support. So if you look first, I'm going to have you squint a lot at graphs, okay? If you look first at the patients who reported getting a lot of positive support from their networks, the dotted line, the flat line on the bottom, you can see the fact that it's flat says it doesn't make a difference if you've got very little problematic support or you're getting a lot of service from your family and friends. It doesn't really make a difference. As long as you've got high positive support, you're going to do okay. But now contrast that for the patients who are receiving little positive support, which is this solid line, okay? You're okay. If you're not getting much positive support, but you're also not getting much problematic support, you also have fairly low depression. But let's look up at this dot right here. This is the group of patients who said, I'm not getting very much positive support from friends and family, and I'm getting a lot of problematic support. So it's that combo that was at high risk for depression. And we've since, in studies, seen this result repeated over and over again. So the bad the bad effects of problematic support become magnified when you don't also get the positive support to cushion it. And this became known as stress buffering. And again, you see rushes toward concepts. Everybody had to test the stress buffering hypothesis for about 10 years, and then everybody got sick of it. That's how you sort of see progress in science and psychology, that everybody likes a particular topic, and then they don't like that topic anymore. Okay. We referred to this effect as a double-edged sword, saying that interactions with the exact same people, including your partner, can be both a stressor itself as well as a buffer of that stress. Now, these data were from the patient's perspective. Would the partners agree? So we went back to interview the partners of those patients in the study who were married. This was Debbie Meyerowitz's MA thesis, because she had sort of come up with the idea. And we went back to their partners, and we did a qualitative study basically asking them what were sort of the issues about that they were coping with. What was stressful about living with someone with RA? And we also asked them about the support they provided to the person. But the stressors, five themes sort of emerged in all their stories. Seeing their wife or husband in pain and feeling helpless to do anything about it. Frustration at the person's increasing physical limitations. Moodiness. Reduction in shared pleasurable activities, such as sex or socializing or just having fun. This was not in the literature, and yet so many people said we lost our life that we used to have. We can't do things because of her disability. And now that's sort of become part of standard scales, but nobody was thinking that way. And fears, understandably, feelings of fear and uncertainty, both about the patient's future health and what was it going to do to the marriage, to the relationship. And at that point, it also became clear from the data that illness had an effect on the person's spouse. Again, well, you know, it's above a psychology. Your grandmother could have told you that. Very few people had actually done any studies of partners or spouses, so that you could see in the early studies that compared to married individuals, spouses of people with RA were at greater risk for depression, they were lonelier, they had more psychological disturbance. So here was the justification to say, we need to look at spouses too. And in fact, I moved off of very quickly patient and partner saying, whoa, 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 it's a couple stressor. There are all kinds of stresses that the couple is facing together when they're living with a chronic illness. So some come directly from caregiving, when you have to make a treatment decision, when you have to manage treatment, or at the end of life when you have to provide hands-on care. Other stresses come from the need when one person's ill, you often have to restructure family roles and responsibilities. And often these are contrary to traditional gender roles. That's another study I can talk about another time. Still, other stressors are really filtered through the lens of the patient, like when the partners would say, I see them in pain, I can't do anything about it. I'm supposed to, I'm their spouse. And illness affects core parts of a relationship, including sexual desire and beliefs about the stability of the marriage. I thought we could get through this. I thought we were together, and this has just crumbled our family. At the same time, you see a lot of couples and families say, we're stronger because of this. But the point is, you can really see very different outcomes in different kinds of couples. So at this point, it really became clear to me that partners occupy a dual role in the coping process. As primary provider of support to the ill person, and as a family member who needs support in coping with the illness, her or himself. Okay, I'm gonna actually skip through these just to show you there are reciprocal effects, because I wanna make sure I get to the data. So now I'm studying couples, not patients and partners. Here's a shameless plug for the book, which I hope your library has. Actually, one of the first book to come out because, and it's actually not terrific, but it's the first book in the sense of there wasn't a lot of research at this time, but it was trying to lay out some of the ideas by a number of different scholars so that maybe people would take up the cause and start studying couples coping. And what it's called is really dyadic coping, not couples coping, because two individuals are involved, and one could look at it with parents and children, one could look at it with friends. I'm looking at it within a marital or intimate relationship context. Broadly cast, dyadic coping recognizes mutuality and interdependence in coping that are responses to a shared stressor. And what it means is that couples respond to these shared stressors as interpersonal units and not as individuals in isolation. So the construct of dyadic coping goes beyond social support or individual coping. Although I have to say, the provision or the exchange of social support is a major component of dyadic coping. And the members of a couple negotiate the emotional aspects of the shared experience. I have a colleague at Mount Sinai, Hoda Bader, who refers to dyadic coping as the couple takes a we approach rather than an I approach. They talk about it as our illness. Okay. Now, the big question then is, great, how does dyadic coping work? And in the 1990s, I proposed a framework of coping congruence to examine dyadic coping processes. Most simply, congruence involves efforts to maximize the fit between the two partners' coping efforts so that they'll be able to cope more effectively and adapt to the illness better as a couple. Okay. But congruence can involve either similarity of coping efforts or complementarity, which isn't a word, but I've now made it one, apparently. The idea that you don't have to be doing the same things in this team or we approach. You can be doing strategies that bolster what the other person is doing. In contrast, incongruence are efforts that really impede the other person's coping efforts. So it's not that you're sort of going on two parallel tracks, but that the efforts really hurt the other person's coping. So this was all very theoretical at the time. So, as a good psychologist, I did a big study to be able to see whether this congruence model worked at all. And I want to, in whatever, thank Debbie Marwitz and Alonza, my two wonderful grad students, now tenured professors and chairs of departments. That's how old I am. And Alan Dubofsky and Steve Padgett. When you're a health psychologist, you cannot exist without wonderful collaborations with physicians who refer patients to your study. So I initially tested the congruence model in a cross-sectional study of 113 heterosexual married couples with rheumatic disease, primarily rheumatoid arthritis, or RA, but a couple of other diagnoses in there. The sample was 75% female patients married to male spouses, because those are the prevalent statistics for rheumatic disease. These were middle-aged couples married for a long time, an average of 30 years. And I gave them the infamous 68-item ways of coping scale. Yes, exhausting.
Didn't you ask me that question already?
Yes, but for psychometric reasons, I have to ask it several times. There's now a short form. Patients reported how they coped with their illness. Partners reported how they coped with the patient's illness, but they were identical questions. So basically, to distill it down, each patient and partner has a score on 7 coping scales from more problem-focused coping strategies that really help you sort of deal with the stressor at hand, down to what are called more emotion-focused strategies, where you're really coping with your own upset and distress that the stressor has caused. And as you can look at those memes, you can see that both patients and partners used very low levels of coping. This was a 1 to 5 scale, so I want to be honest up front and say, we're talking about the bottom of the range here. People are not exerting efforts. And I think that's because they have been coping with the illness for anywhere from 6 months to several years. So it wasn't brand new. For all the strategies, patients did more coping than partners, though only the bold numbers are statistically significant. And I'm going to keep saying this today because it's not a gender talk, but this isn't due to gender. I wanted to look at couples coping together. No one had done this before. And I used a statistical technique called cluster analysis, which I'm not going to go into the statistics of it, but I am going to use it. So let me tell you what it does. So I linked the patients and partners' coping scores. So the couple becomes the unit of analysis, okay? And what it does, it develops couples' profiles. Just as if you're a psychologist and you give someone a scale, you can come up with a profile of a person as a paranoid personality or something. Cluster analysis can help us describe couples coping across these 7 strategies. So it's not just, oh, they used a lot of problem solving. It's, here's a group of couples who's using a lot of problem solving and they're not finding blame and they're doing this and they're doing that. So the idea was to combine things. Basically, I came up with 4 clusters through this analysis and I'm going to show them to you graphically to give you the results. All of these are the 4 clusters are going to look identical. On the x-axis, I have the 7 strategies. I've got the patient score in Cranberry, honoring Massachusetts, and the partners behind them, in grape. And the y-axis is really just how much of each type of coping strategy are they doing, okay? So this is cluster 1. Which we called effortful partnerships. Overall, patients and partners in this cluster were pretty congruent in their coping efforts. For the couples in this cluster, coping was characterized primarily by problem solving, rational thinking. I think the names of the strategies I'm hoping are self-evident. If they're not, I can explain them. Seeking support from others, but also escaping from the stressor, avoiding it, distancing oneself, and blame, which involved both self-blame and blaming others. But most importantly, what I want you to see, even though I'm calling this a congruent cluster, because it was, because there aren't significant differences between patients and partners, is that patients are using more of every strategy except passively accepting the illness than their partners are. So in this cluster, I'm calling them effortful partnerships because they're congruent. They're using the same strategies, they're coping together, and they're coping actively with their illness. Okay, the second cluster, we never came up with a great name for, so I'll take ideas at the end of the day, is sort of one that represents moderate congruence. If you look at patients and partners in this one, you see a lot of different sizes of building blocks that, for some strategies, both the patients and partners are using them pretty much equally the same. The two most problem-focused strategies, problem solving and rational thinking. And for others, they really differ in the degree that they're using them. Like patients in this cluster are using a lot of distancing. Their spouses aren't. Patients are doing no blame. Spouses are doing some. Okay? So they're congruent on some strategies, not on others. It's sort of a mixed bag. The third cluster, now you squint right. What do you see? You see it looks like a field of corn or something. It's flat. Nobody's doing anything here. So I could say this cluster is congruent because they're not coping at all. all that we see is that the spouses are using a little bit of distancing, but that's really not very much. Nobody's really coping. Debbie Marowitz called these sports copers. They're too busy watching TV, but we didn't use that. My colleague Kay Doe said, why don't you call them minimalists? She was into art appreciation at the time. So we call them minimalist copers. This is the fun thing about naming things in psychology, because once you name them, the names become real. Okay, the fourth cluster, we call them, it's a sad one, and the patient copes alone. This is the incongruent cluster, where they're pretty much statistically different on each strategy. As shown by the cranberry bars, you can see the patients are exerting a fair amount, that comes up to about a 2.5 on a 5-point scale, a fair amount of problem and emotion-focused efforts across the board. The only thing they're not doing is escape into fantasy or blame, but they're doing pretty much all the others. And then when we look at their, partners behind them, we see the partners are doing very little. So we call this, and the patient copes alone. So in sum, when I looked at this, there are really sort of two clusters that are congruent. One, that first effortful partnerships, it's doing a lot of coping, and then the very flat one, the minimalist copers, they're congruent, they're both doing nothing. And two clusters that are more incongruent, one that's sort of mixed, and the other where the patient is doing all the coping. All right, cute names, interesting descriptions, but do they mean anything? So what we then did is we said, let's take these four groups, these four cluster profiles, and then let's look at differences. Let's see if the context of the illness, the rest of the context of their life, affects their coping and their adjustment. And the first question that the doctors always say is they go, oh, they've got different levels of disease severity. Basically, on not one of the medical variables were these clusters different. So that's not explaining it. Okay? But there were other significant differences. And they all pretty much lie with cluster one, those effortful partnerships versus the other three clusters. The patients in the effortful partnerships, that was the group again, they're coping congruently, they're using a lot of effort, they're doing a lot of coping. The patients had much higher depression scores. A third of them had clinically indicative depression scores. The spouses reported greater stress in many domains. They reported greater conflict with other friends and family. They're the ones who really reported what are called illness intrusions, how the illness just gnaws away at everyday life. And they reported greater caregiver burden, feeling that they were just having to take care of the person and sort of deal with the whole family. So that we could really see that that cluster one looked different. And now that everybody this decade is into personal growth, we did not know it back then. Patients and partners in this first cluster reported a much greater amount of personal growth. We had made up a scale about how much do you think you grew from the illness, how much do you think you became a better person, because we wanted to end these three-hour interviews on a positive note. We didn't want to just end them seriously with depression scales, stress scales. So we put in this five-item scale, and we also had a question about what would you tell other patients, but the idea was to try to bring their mood up. Little did I realize 20 years later, or whatever, that they're citing this as one of the first personal growth studies, and it's like, if we only knew, we could have made $1 million. But that's, again, how research does not go in this linear way. Okay, so what do these data signify about couples coping? Okay, I've talked a lot about social support exchange, as couples and couples coping as a tango, a very stylized dance, because as I suggested earlier, partners have, and this was way before Dancing with the Stars, partners must coordinate sort of the offering and receipt of support. That guy who said, you know, all right, she yelled at me, I cooked dinner, then I made breakfast and she yelled at me. It's this notion of communicating with someone so you know what they need, when they need it, trying to sense it, and that's a very tough thing for any dyad, much less dyads facing chronic illness. So in this study, I had originally thought, oh, I'll be able to talk about the congruent couples as tangoing and the non-congruent couples not tangling. But what really became clear from those four clusters is that not everybody tangoes so elegantly. This is the effortful partnerships cluster. Remember, they were more distressed. The partners were distressed. They felt burdened. And it's possible, and they were doing a lot of coping. Now, if I just had looked at a correlation, I might have said, oh, lots of coping, bad outcomes. They're more distressed. because this was actually a longitudinal study, so there are causal relationships here. But instead, with this strategy, it became clear, well, wait a minute, maybe all these efforts are just being done because they're not able to handle things. They're working as a team, they're working together, but there's a lot of pain and disability. They're recently diagnosed, so maybe it's not all this coping leads to bad outcomes. Maybe the feelings of depression, the feelings of burden, are leading them to really try anything they can. And again, remember, this was the cluster with the highest scores, significantly higher scores than the other three clusters on personal growth. So despite the fact that they're tearing up the room and sort of destroying their lives in some ways, they also really saw some positives in the illness experience. They could see benefits from their struggle. And more importantly, they were dancing as a team, even if they destroyed the room in the process. Now, the cluster I called "And the Patient Copes Alone" showed the most incongruence. Patients, remember, were actively coping. The partners weren't doing a lot. But really, the patients and the partners weren't so distressed in this particular cluster. And one other interesting thing is this was the oldest cluster in the sample. Their mean was in the late 60s versus the mid-50s. And it suggested to me, not proof of evidence, but a suggestion that perhaps the couples had developed styles of coping that were independent. Remember, they were incongruent. But maybe they were complementary. Maybe at this point the patient really did need to sort of deal with treatment and going to things and didn't need the help as much. So the notion was incongruent coping didn't have worse outcomes. It was just different. So coping isn't just equivalent to the amount of effort you're expending. So that's not necessarily good. And congruence doesn't just answer it completely. Let me also tell you that I replicated this study with a pain sample with Dirte Jungkanel, who is a postdoc of mine, and we found basically the same issues, that incongruence has slightly worse outcomes, but not that much that you would really want to come down and say you need this congruent kind of coping. And I'm not going to show you that study today because you've had enough of clusters. What I will show you is a recent study that's in press in the journal Health Psychology right now about dyadic coping with couples facing metastatic breast cancer. Okay. We used a different theoretical model in this study to examine whether this collaborative team dyadic coping affects adaptation to the illness above and beyond social support exchange. So we're not ignoring the importance of social support, but we're asking the question, does coping add something above and beyond support? And in this study, we looked at both individual level outcomes, the patient and the partner's cancer-related distress, and we also looked at a couple's level outcome, marital adjustment or relationship satisfaction. Here's your theory for this study. This is yucky, I see now. Okay, but this is the model of, this is in the book, Wadwook, no. This is the model of dyadic coping that we tested called the systemic transactional model. This was developed by a Swiss colleague of ours, Guy Bodman. And this model conceptualizes and measures dyadic coping as a process. That's an interactive process, hence the arrows. What's happening from top to bottom is that the coping efforts or coping reactions of one partner take into account the stress signals of the other partner. So they are still dancing a little bit back and forth. So it starts out with a share, so he calls this communication of stress process by partner A. So it starts out with a shared stressor at the top. When faced with a shared stressor, like being diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, partners cope both individually and collectively as a unit. At the individual level, they make the same, remember the cognitive stress appraisals, based on their individual needs and concerns. And then these appraisals trigger a stress communication process between the partners. So I'm going to be telling my partner, it's really hard for me to cook the dinner tonight, or I'm just exhausted, hoping that that will trigger a supportive response, or a let's go out, let's order in Chinese, something like that. But then the other person said, I just had a terrible day at work. I really don't feel cooking. So it's again this dyadic back and forth with the arrows that one person's stress communication elicits a response, which elicits a response, which elicits a response, okay? So if one partner sends out a stress communication, the other can respond in simplistically a supportive or an unsupportive fashion. So supportive responses in this study include providing advice, practical help with daily tasks, showing empathy and concern, expressing solidarity, helping your partner to relax and engage in other items, engage in like positive reframing of the stressor, very similar to the types of support I showed you earlier. Unsupportive responses include showing disinterest, providing support that's accompanied by criticism, distancing, sarcasm, or minimizing the severity of the stressor, not the response that the person wanted when they threw that stress communication out there. And this coping is considered dyadic because both partners are involved. But at this point in the model, each person's involvement is sort of just kept with responding to the other person. So there's a second dyadic component in this model. At the couple level, relational well-being is affected by the couple's ability to work as a team to manage the dyadic stressor. It's not just, I need this, you give me it, you don't. It's coping as a couple. And there are two forms of coping that I'm going to talk about. Guy Bodman calls them common positive dyadic coping and common negative dyadic coping. The common I realized after working with him for 5 years was sort of bad translation from the German. No, I mean, when I was really like, Guy, why is it common? Is it common? Is it everybody? And he was just using it meaning in common. They do this coping strategy in common together. By then, he had published about 30 articles and didn't want to change it. But that's, whenever I hear for common, it's sort of, what does that mean? So I'm going to title them differently in this study. So the common positive dyadic coping involves joint problem solving, coordinating everyday demands, relaxing together, mutual calming each other, sharing, expressing solidarity. It's the positive dyadic coping. Common negative dyadic coping involves mutual avoidance and withdrawal. So this is different than I give you a stress communication and you say, not tonight, dear. This is where sort of our coping pattern is you're upset, and neither of us wants to deal with this, and we walk away. So it's on the couple's level. Okay, in the metastatic or breast cancer MBC study, it was a sample of 191 couples. The method was we gave questionnaires to the patients and the partner separately. They completed them 3 times, first when they were initiating their treatment for metastatic breast cancer, 3 months later, and 6 months later. Mean age was 54. Again, we're replicating what breast cancer looks like at this point. 93% white and well-educated. Unfortunately, and not just in New York City, this is your modal breast cancer study, which I feel really bad about in New York City because we are not a 93% white city. And we can talk tomorrow morning about how hard it is to bring in diverse samples into the studies. You know that well. Let me just tell you the measures for this study so when we talk about them, you'll know. So the outcomes were the individual level study, the cancer-related distress, which is the impact of event scale, which measures intrusive thoughts about your cancer and then trying to get those thoughts out of your mind. The couples level variable was the dyadic, it's called the dyadic adjustment scale. It is the proxy measure for relationship satisfaction in American psychology today. Supportive coping, again, according to Guy's model, from each partner we asked about their perceived partner supportive coping. So each person was asked about the other and unsupportive coping. And the dyadic coping we asked about, I'm calling it collaborative coping and mutual avoidance. Call it what it is as opposed to common positive dyadic coping. Okay. And the analyses here, again, not going to go into them because I just took a course in it last year. We used hierarchical linear modeling or multi-level modeling. What this allows you to do and why this is the essential strategy for couples or families or schools, by the way, or neighborhoods, is it allows you to acknowledge that there are individuals within a social group. So if you're studying schools, you could say, well, these classrooms are nested within schools. So I'm not just going to compare classroom A and B. It's classroom A in school one. We can use this for couples because you can look at the patient and the partner as nested within a couple. So it allows you to look at both individual effects and couples effects. It also lets us look across time, given we had 3 points of data. So it acknowledges the fact that patients and partners are not independent, that clearly their coping is related, you know, because they live together, whereas most of the early studies couldn't really statistically acknowledge that, okay? And I'm just sort of, so you can understand what we did, we're going to ultimately look at the bottom. We're going to say, does dyadic coping make a difference? Does it make a difference above and beyond what supportive coping does for well-being? And we also stuck in some covariates because the length of relationship was related to the two outcomes and also that cancer-related stress communication. So I did it backwards, but basically each time you add a step, think of it as I'm asking about the unique effect of that variable. Okay, let's look at cancer-related distress first. And I'll go, the bold ones are the significant findings, so you can squint and look at those. So even holding perceptions of supportive coping constant, we find that collaborative coping makes a difference, but it makes a different difference for patients and spouses. There was a significant interaction. Patients who use more collaborative coping, and patients are women here, but we're calling them patients, had much more cancer-related distress. In contrast, their partners using collaborative coping had lower distress. So it's having opposite effects. That's very important. When we look at mutual avoidance, we find for both patients and partners, it's increasing their cancer-related distress. Even if we, yes, social support makes a difference, but this mutual avoidance makes a difference above and beyond that. When we look at dyadic adjustment as an outcome, again, as you can see, the supportive and unsupportive coping, they are making a difference. But here, we find a mirror image. Collaborative coping is related to better dyadic adjustment. So patients and partners, if they use more collaborative coping, have more relationship satisfaction. Here we didn't find the opposite effects we found for individual distress. And again, the same thing here with mutual avoidance coping. If the partners use that, less satisfied with the relationship. Okay? So as with the rheumatoid arthritis study, we can see that metastatic breast cancer affects both members of the couple, even though they're experiencing extreme stress. And here we're dealing with an illness that has life threat. Most metastatic breast cancer patients have about a 2-year prognosis at this point with the treatments. Even as they're experiencing extreme stress, patients and partners often act as the primary support provider for each other. This was at what's called a very stringent test of dyadic coping, meaning we're pulling out all these other things and saying, even when you control for these other things, does it make a difference? We found that that positive form, the collaborative coping, was associated with better relationship satisfaction for patients and partners, and that mutual avoidance was related with both greater individual distress and lower relationship satisfaction. So taken together, the two studies I presented today, I think, lead to a couple of conclusions. One is collaborative coping is a good thing for well-being, but we have to acknowledge it may not affect patients and partners in the same way, and here's what we need to do in the next studies. In the metastatic breast cancer study, they went in different directions. Patients had an increase in distress, partners a decrease. Now, the theory would go that engaging in collaborative coping helps restore a sense of normalcy during a non-normal time, a stressful time. It might reinforce the strength of the marriage. It's a we disease. We're facing it together. And relating as spouses, even just through shared activities, pleasurable activities, may really reduce partners' caregiver burden, which was a big deal in the arthritis study, and sort of lead to better communication. It may also provide an opportunity. If you're doing things together, you sort of have the opportunity to be supportive to each other. You lose the role of just being a cancer patient and a caregiver, which is, by the way the National Cancer Institute frames it. You sort of lose those roles if you're doing things together. But from that increase in distress, what it also shows, it may also create additional distress. That for patients, why would it be that this collaborative coping that's supposed to be so good creates distress? And again, this mirrors the RA study of those effortful partnerships. Okay. The fact that it requires both persons to actively participate in coping might be one of the factors, because if you're a patient, you've been recently diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, you have a lot of treatments, you have a lot on your emotional plate to deal with, and it may be that it's really hard at this point for you to be supportive for your spouse. I'm not suggesting it's not difficult in the other direction at all, but it may be that at that point you are coping with so many treatment demands and things you can't be supportive. So being together and trying to relax and do fun things may sort of bring up an awareness that you're not pulling your weight, or an awareness that you're taxing the partner. And we know from that from other studies that often spouses hide their emotional distress from each other in a strategy called protective buffering. It may be that for patients who are already distressed when they sort of are diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer or then on, engaging in this common dyadic coping, in this collaborative coping, may sort of be overwhelming, may become another stressor. We have to have fun together. We really have to make sure we go to the movies. So we're going to look at this further, Hoda and I, in a study of prostate cancer patients next year. A second conclusion I want to bring home, 1N1, good trace, is that partners may be experiencing greater stress than we imagine. There is a recent review that came out in the journal Health Psychology in 2008 by my colleague Mariette Hagedorn, who's from the Netherlands, where she really does a review of all the studies and unpacks, is it gender or is it patient-partner role? And really comes up with the fact that different studies show that partners are more distressed than the patients. But because so many illness studies are single-sex studies, because the majority of cancer studies are breast and prostate, for example, we can't really answer that question. And I can't answer this question in this study either, because all the patients are women. Hoda and I had a long discussion about, do we frame this as gender or frame this as patient-partner role here? Because you could say the same thing, but it was really how are the people operating, and our decision was to go with patient-partner because we hadn't really studied gender. But really, it's to acknowledge the fact why we have to look at couples coping is that partners are experiencing a great deal of illness stress too, and yet they're the major motor driving sort of how the patient adapts. The discrepancy we saw in the metastatic breast cancer study that's been found in other studies raises concerns because it's also showing if there are different effects of the stressor, there may not be communication. So from a clinical perspective, these data really suggest that therapists need to start thinking about couples-based interventions. There are very, very few around for couples with chronic illness. Lynn Martier at the University of Pittsburgh did a recent review to say, does it help to bring a family member to therapy? And the answer was, sometimes yes, sometimes no. But then she also raised the fact that most of the time it's bringing your spouse, bringing your daughter, as opposed to designing a treatment that's really about the couple or the family. So I think this is where the literature, the research, and the practice is going to be going in the next 10 years, to really start looking at couples-based or family-based interventions and not, well, we've got the ill person and let's get in as many people as we can. The study also raises lots of unanswered questions. The two I want to leave you with today are, how do contextual factors such as race, ethnicity, social class, and sexual orientation affect couples coping? Answer, who knows, because nobody's studying them. I've just completed a literature review of female sexual adjustment after cancer. They're all white. They're all middle to upper class. We're lucky if they even put that data in the article. I was blown away by how many studies don't even bother to specify anything. In fact, there were a number of studies where we weren't sure they were women, meaning they don't even report gender. One study reports sexual orientation out of 281. So obviously, as my former grad student, who's now a professor at the University of Michigan, who worked on this sex study with me, said is, when you give these talks, you have to just put up the empty cells, the notion of we don't know, as opposed to here's the, most patients are white. Why don't you put up the data that says in 70% of the studies, they don't even tell us the ethnicity. Then say of the 30% that do, here's, it's mostly white. So part of it is we're not doing a very good job in health psychology with this. And the second is, what's gender got to do with it? A lot, as I said. And that's another issue that we have to deal with, but is very difficult to deal with because of the prevalence of different diseases and different treatments. So we have to really start thinking about gender as we design our studies, not as an after-the-fact issue or as a t-test between men and women. We really have to say, where does gender come into this and who do I need to study? Because this question irks me so much, I'm doing a clinical trial now of expressive writing, which is where you write about your deepest thoughts and feelings. We chose to study colorectal cancer because the prevalence statistics were the same. The treatment was the same. So we can really look at gender differences in expressive writing and in disclosure about cancer-related concerns to be able to really say, is it about gender or is it about the patient-partner role? Okay. So to end, let me go back to the beginning, back to the title of the talk, Are Close Relationships Good Medicine for People Coping with Chronic Illness? It depends. I know you want an answer, but we don't know yet. Illness is clearly a couple stressor. It impacts the spouse as well as the patient. Partner support responses and coping can affect the patient's well-being. Congruence in coping, that tango doesn't do it, but maybe a little nice close dancing might. And you also have to focus on the positives in the relationship and not simply the negatives. So I'm urging my colleagues in health psychology to start studying couples and families from the beginning, to think about couples interventions, and who knows, maybe dance lessons. Thank you.